The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning. I call this meeting to order. I'd like to begin with introductions. And today we have I'd like to begin with Ms. Freen. Just introduce yourself and the constituency you're from. And
sorry, Joyce Train, MLA for Cole Harbour Eastern Passage.
Stephen Goff, MLA for Sackville Beaver Bank.
Good morning, Alan Rowe, MLA for Dartmouth South.
Joachim Stroink, MLA for Halifax Chibucto.
Morning, Keith Irving, MLA King South, sitting in for Ian Rankin.
Morning, Chuck Porter, MLA Hans West.
Good morning, Maureen McDonald, Halifax Needham.
Good morning, Sterling Bellevue, MLA for Queens Shelburne, and I'm setting in for Dave Wilson.
Thank you, everybody. Today we have the Chief Information Officer with us. We're going to be discussing controls over the disposal of IT assets. This was reported in the November 2013 report of the Auditor General, and our guests to begin with an introduction, and then we'll follow up with questions.
Okay. Carolyn McKenzie, Director of Client Services with the Chief Information Office.
Sandra Cascaden, the Chief Information Officer.
Blaine Maxwell, Director of Service Management.
You may begin with your introduction for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today to discuss the disposal of government IT assets. With me this morning, as we've already introduced, is Blaine Maxwell, the Director of Services Management for the Chief Information Office, or the CIO, which we'll call it, and Carolyn McKenzie, the Director of Client Services. My opening comments this morning will focus on what we do at the CIO and the results we are delivering for clients and citizens. The office has the mandate to plan, organize, direct, and the strategic direction and leadership for information management and information technology across government. Our job is to protect information, to secure the infrastructure, to ensure that IT investments and resources are used to their full capacity in order to get the most value for taxpayers' dollars. But most simply, our job is to ensure that we're doing the right things, doing them the right way, doing them well, and getting benefits. The office was created in April 2009. I joined the office in September 2013. Our current operating budget is $31.76 million for the 13-14 fiscal year. We also spent about $11 million this year on capital projects and improving our infrastructure. To give you a flavor of that work, one of the key capital projects for this year was the rollout of Microsoft to all government computers at a cost of about $1 million. We also made $2 million worth of improvements to the provincial data network this year, and that will continue into the next fiscal year. Finally, we invested about $2 million this year in the planning and the development of a project called Signet, which will improve the government's ability to deliver online transactions for citizens in a secure and private way. The Chief Information Office plays an important role in supporting government's overall goals and priorities by setting IT strategies, policies, standards, frameworks, solutions that support and enable the government efforts. Our vision on how we deliver on our mandate as a corporate service revolves around three drivers: information, mobility, and connectivity. Currently, the office has 223 staff who work from five locations in Halifax and from a number of regional locations throughout the province to support the technology needs of thousands of government employees. So the office manages about 10,900 desktops and laptops, 5,300 mobile phones, and 15,000 phone lines. So those are just some of the metrics of our infrastructure. We are currently managing over 37 IT projects at various stages, various levels of complexity, for various government departments. Our service desk manages about 400 calls a day, and we flow information through over 16,000 email boxes. The services we provide allow citizens to do everything from renewing your vehicle permit online to finding out how to access the numerous services that government provides citizens and businesses. We make it possible for them to register a birth or a business, and we make it possible to get the latest provincial road report. The services and the role the office plays has changed over the short time it's been in existence. In particular, the way we deliver our services changed substantially in the recent years, as we have implemented efforts to be more client-focused and better coordinated across all of government. We live in a world today where technology improves and changes so fast it can be a challenge to keep up. Citizens and other stakeholders have come to expect government to be open and sharing of some information. At the same time, they rely on us to be diligent and protective of other information. You seldom see staff of the Chief Information Office, but they're always behind the scenes working to meet the client demands through the support and the expansion of government-wide infrastructure, systems, and policies. Within government, our clients want to be able to work on the move. They want technology that they can depend on and that'll work in the office and on the road. It has to be dependable and easy to use, and it has to make their jobs easier so they, in turn, can deliver programs and services which Nova Scotians have come to depend. The office, in partnership with information technology colleagues in the other departments through government, provides corporate service designed to help government clients attain their business goals. The office will continue to focus on broad public sector collaboration, standardization, consolidation of information in the technology environments. In addition to the ongoing work, this year the office is focused on achieving three major outcomes: a transformed Chief Information Office with a new organization structure that is better positioned to offer corporate services that focus on the government clients; an enabled workforce supporting our workforce by leveraging mobile, social, information, and cloud technologies; and advancing tools and services to allow better accessibility, information services, solutions that ensure security and information of the information and infrastructure at a cost-effective delivery method. I'd like to touch briefly on today's topic of IT asset management and disposal in particular, one of the more important services we provide government-wide. The Chief Information Office is committed to supporting the Auditor General's recommendation from the 2013 report on the controls and disposal of assets. This will be achieved by adopting best practice of continual service improvement, which will standardize and provide consistency to many of the processes required to deliver asset management service to our clients. We have prioritized all of the Auditor General's recommendations from the recent audit, and we have started with the most significant actions that would have the greatest impact, and we have already completed a number of these recommendations. We have made substantial efforts creating and applying standards to ensure the data is wiped from computers before we dispose of them, and the government turns over about 25% of its total supply of desktops and laptops each year. And on that point, I'm pleased to note that 90% of our used computers are actually transferred to the Computers for Schools program, going to students and schools across the province who can continue to make good use of these tools. We have initiated improved tracking systems to allow us to quickly and easily determine if a computer is cleaned and ready to be transferred. We manage this service in collaboration with the corporate service units, or the IT people in the other departments, and we work directly with them in each department. These folks are responsible for the hands-on management of each of the department technologies. It's a strong and successful working relationship, and we continue to improve our supports to the CSUs through the ongoing development and the delivery of standards from the Chief Information Office, allowing increased consistency, quality in securing, managing, and the disposal of assets. It's a time of great change and an opportunity for the government's information technology community. The goal is to work collaboratively to meet the challenges and ensure opportunities are realized to the benefit of Nova Scotians. I am privileged to be in this position to provide leadership and direction to achieve an important mandate of the Chief Information Office. And with those comments, I thank you for your attention and I welcome your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cascaden. And we'll begin with Mr. Porter for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to our meeting this morning. Thank you for being here. Always an interesting topic. We've discussed this over the years, at least in my time in this committee, which is, I guess, now going on 8 years, believe it or not, that we've had IT before us a few times, and it always ends up being a fairly interesting topic for us. So I've got a number of questions. I'll probably bounce around a little bit from one thing to the other, but I want to start with the Auditor General's recommendations. And can you update us where the department is right now, where your office is with regards to those recommendations?
Certainly. There were a number of recommendations specifically directed to the CIO office, as well as recommendations that were directed to each of the individual departments. So I'll go through each one of the recommendations from the CIO office. On recommendation 201, which asks and recommends actually that we start encrypting data on computers, I'm very, very pleased to say that we've actually started our encryption program. And again, because there are a number of recommendations here, we took the opportunity to prioritize which one of these various recommendations we'd work on. This one was prioritized very high, just from a risk perspective. And what we did is we prioritized moving laptops and putting encryption on laptops first, because of course they're a high-risk device, they move around. So we have approximately 2,000 laptops that we are targeting to have encryption on, and we currently have 851 of those laptops as of yesterday encrypted. So we're moving very, very quickly to encrypt those kind of high-risk mobile devices. We prioritize laptops first, desktops second, based on a risk analysis. So that's where we are on recommendation 201. With regard to recommendation 207, we have that recommendation was to update the standards for the wide area network policy and categories of information technology and assets covered by this policy. We have created a new and updated policy. Those policies go through multiple committees within the CIO office in order to garner approval. That policy went to the Standards Committee on February the 24th, so that means the policy is actually written, and it was tabled in front of our Standards Committee, which is made up of multiple representatives from different IT groups. That particular policy, unfortunately, it wasn't approved by the Standards Committee. The Standards Committee asked for a couple of other changes and refinements to that particular policy. So the Standards Committee is doing what it's supposed to do by looking at the policy, but it will be going back into our Standards Committee. So we'll have recommendation 207 covered off very, very shortly as well. Recommendation 208, in which the Chief Information Office should document the information technology disposal of assets process. There was a supplemental piece of information that was attached to the documents that you received today. Inside that document actually shows a number of new processes and procedures that we have actually documented. Those would be some of the flow charts inside of that package. So again, I'm very happy to say that we are moving forward with our documentation and the supplemental information that you received today actually demonstrates the documentation that we've moved forward with. On recommendation 209, the Chief Information Office should use a sanitized, secure wiping software tool that records and reports on the whole wiping process. We are currently looking at a number of different tools, and we have to assess those tools based on our environment. So we have not procured a tool yet, but we are actively looking at a tool. In order to make sure that we do document the process, we've actually put a number of manual processes in place. So we have a manual process until the time that we get a tool which will automate the process a whole lot more. On recommendation 210, the Chief Information Office should implement a standard procedure that provides visual identification on whether information technology assets have been wiped. Again, in your supplementary documentation, there's a page that has different colored labels on it. So when assets come in to be disposed, we actually put one of those very large labels on front of each of those assets, and it will tell the status of the asset at a very quick visual inspection. So we have completed recommendation 210. That we do have a reference label scheme for the disposal of assets. Recommendation 211, where the Chief Information Office should periodically verify computers sent for disposal are wiped. We put together a process for which we will do our own audits of devices after they've come out of the wiping process. So we put together the process. We put together the documentation. We have developed a checklist associated with those processes. And we actually did our first trial run of that self-audit. And we picked 21 computers that went through the whole process. And we were very pleased to say that of those 21 computers, all those 21 computers had been appropriately wiped. The audit document that we are using is also part of the supplementary documentation that you received today. The documentation is actually on the last page of the documents you received today. So we have a process that is actually fully documented and forms that we are using. On recommendation 212, the Chief Information Office should develop a process to ensure all information technology asset disposals it performs are recorded in a centralized tracking system. The IT assets are considered an asset, just like a desk, a chair is considered an asset, and transportation and infrastructure renewal are responsible for collecting and managing all assets. So we actually use the Transportation Infrastructure Renewals database. So we're making some changes, and they're making some upgrades to their system as well. We believe that we may need to procure another tool that will automate the front end of our process that is very, very specific for IT, and then we will bolt it on to the database that TIR has. With regard to the recommendation for the CIO office, 213, where the Chief Information Office should retain specific disposal details for each asset and services that it's sanitized the dates of the disposals. So basically, he was looking for a more detailed report. We have implemented a manual tracking system. So for all of the assets that we are disposing of, we have a manual tracking system for us in the CIO, and then we manually link that to the system in TIR. When we are looking at a tool to automate the IT side of the process, this manual process that we put in place will go away, and it'll be a much more automated and much more smooth process. So that's where we stand on each one of the recommendations.
Thank you very much for a very detailed answer. And that's okay, though, because there was, there were a few recommendations in there that were quite important, and people were wondering where they're at, including us. Right. You talked about, 2,000 laptops being your first priority, 851 of those complete. When did you start that process, and how long has it taken to get those 851 done?
Well, the process actually starts well before the first device is encrypted, because we have to make sure that we select an encryption technology. We know the implications of encrypting. We know which assets we can actually encrypt. Just because you have a laptop doesn't necessarily mean that that laptop can be encrypted, because some of the older laptops actually cannot be encrypted. It's just the newer ones. So the first devices that we touched was about 2.5 weeks ago, and we've been able to move forward with 851.
So that's moving rather rapidly. So the of those, just picked up on a piece, some of them can't be encrypted. Of the 851 that, or of the 2,000, those 851 have the ability to be encrypted then at this point. How many of the 2,000 do you know won't?
So 2,000 of the 2,000 we know can be encrypted.
Oh, it can be encrypted.
That's correct.
Thanks for that clarity. Okay.
And any new computer that's purchased,
yeah,
will have newer technology. We know those can also be encrypted.
Right. And what's our total just of assets with regards to desktops, laptops, et cetera, that are needing to meet this requirement overall? Do you know?
So we would like to, and our target would be to have encryption on 100% of the devices. So that would, yeah, be the 10,900 that I had mentioned is our, on our inventory. Our process, and I had mentioned before that we really need to prioritize it, because we can't kind of do everything all at the same time. So we look at the high risk, which was laptops. We look at those laptops which we can encrypt, and we move those ones forward. Those ones that cannot be encrypted, they will be coming through a replacement cycle, and so we will replace those, and everything that's newly procured from April the 1st onward, we will encrypt before it ever reaches the client's desk. We'll then start looking backwards in time for all the newer assets that have been procured over the last 6 or 8 months, and we will start to encrypt those ones. We will not attempt to encrypt older devices, because we know that they are going to be recycled at a certain period of time. And so that's the kind of risk-benefit analysis that we do.
A lot of us carry mobile devices, as you know. What's the status with regards to those? I mean, BlackBerries, can they be encrypted as an example?
So, yes, BlackBerries themselves are already encrypted. So, and the other devices that we're also supporting, like iPhones, the way that we are rolling them out, you work in a very secure container, and if anything happens to that device, we turn the container off and we turn access to that device off immediately. Hmm. So we have a lot of control over those mobile devices.
That's good. Thank you. So, like I said, always an interesting topic. I think about significant departments, I'll call them, Justice, Community Services, Health. We've heard in the past how some health records have been accessed by people that shouldn't have had access to them. That has been discussed in this very chamber and in this very public account setting in the past. Have we had any significant breaches in the last while that you're aware of, and can you talk about that a bit?
So from an access to information perspective, there are multiple different types of, you know, way breaches can happen. One is somebody leaves a device somewhere and somebody picks it up and then looks at that device. Well, the encryption and the other methods that we're taking to secure those devices, the fact that they have to have a username and password on them when you open them up, we can manage those devices that way. There's other breaches that are more to people already have access to an information system, and they're just going places they shouldn't be going based on what their access is. And that's a different type of breach, which we're not controlling. Yeah. That's controlled by the lines of business who own those particular applications. So some of the breaches that have been discussed before are really about people who have had access to a system but are going to places and looking at information they shouldn't be looking at because they don't need to do it, don't need to look at that information for their own job. Those we don't have any insight into because we're managing the physical assets. We're not actually managing the access associated with the system.
So you're not doing anything with regards to the actual passwords themselves here? You make your recommendations with regards to it being a safe or a difficult or whatever the right terminology is for having a password as secure as you can possibly make a change in them on a regular basis and so on, but you really don't have anything past that. Is that correct?
That's correct. We set the standards and the policies and the best practices to say your password has to be greater than 8 characters long, numbers, capitals, and we would hope that each one of the various departments who own the information system will adhere to that. There are certain corporate assets that we do manage directly as the CIO. That's the email system. So that's where we have direct command and control over that particular asset. But an asset like a hospital information system, we don't have any. It's completely separate.
Okay. I want to get to the assets in general, a little more specific. There are many, as we know. There are multiple departments. Is the purchasing, just as an example, does your department, your office, purchase all of the assets? Like, would you, when health or justice or community service or anyone for that matter, any department or others, does that all go through one purchasing, or does that go, you know, does each department do their own thing? How does that work?
So I'll start with just a little bit of an explanation of what happened pre the creation of the CIO. Okay. Before the CIO office was in place, each department, each entity procured all of their own assets. So they could choose which assets they wanted. And when the CIO was formed and we did a whole asset inventory, there were multiple different types of assets everywhere. So over the last couple of years, we have been working diligently to create standards. And we have been successful in creating a single standard around desktops and laptops, which is HP. And that now makes our environment much more manageable as we do those standards.
Just the sorry to interrupt, but just on that, is the bulk of that now done, over the, or are we still a long ways from being the bulk done to that HP as a standard, as an example?
So so the HP started about 2 years ago, yeah. And what happens is it'll take us 4 years to get to a homogeneous environment just because of the length of the refresh strategy. Most government departments are actually procuring through through the CIO process, because we have an online process that makes it really easy for people to procure their computers. And when they procure it through the CIO process, we actually then can manage that asset all the way from procurement through disposition.
Is that a requirement now, or is that not?
It is not a requirement, okay, that people actually use the CIO process, and there are some entities that don't use the CIO process at this point.
Why would that be?
I think this one I may pass to Carolyn, okay, because she works directly with this.
Sure.
Ms. McKenzie?
Thank you. So essentially, the majority of our government departments use our processes. We do have some arm's length organizations that receive service from the CIO. So one good example would be the Auditor General, Utility and Review Board, the Judiciary, which falls under Justice. They do, use some of our processes, but not complete all of, where they are arm's length organizations, kind of pick and choose which ones fit their business requirements. So we do have some, a good example would be the Office of the Auditor General purchases Toshiba's versus HP. So that would be a good example of someone who, you know, would use the process. We support them, we kind of do some management on them, but, you know, it's every, the full cycle isn't followed under our process. But in advance as well, Department of Community Services was following our processes, but actually doing their own procurement. And we've been working closely with them where they're actually our office will start to do their procurement and have worked through a transition plan. So we that's one good of example of a government department who was retaining the procurement process on laptops and desktops, but have recently now have been working closely with Blaine's team on bringing their process into ours.
Mr. Porter, you have 1 minute left.
Okay, thank you, and I'll just ask this then quickly. Just why the HP, I guess, is the standard versus something else then?
When we did HP, that was part of a strategic procurement initiative that was led through the Treasury Board, and really it was a cross-sector initiative where school boards, health, and government basically went through a process to said, if we increase our purchasing volume, can we get a lower price?
Okay.
And so through a process that was led through government procurement, you know, and a cross-sector evaluation panel, we landed on HP as our standard. Prior to that, we this HP contract, we would have had about 25 different models where we basically went had Dell, HP, and then potentially a third contender on our standing offer for purchase.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And we'll now move to Ms. McDonald and the NDP caucus.
Thank you very much. Good morning. This is very interesting. It's such an important topic, I think. People in the province, in the community that I represent, certainly are always really concerned about identity theft and privacy, confidentiality, and increasingly so much information about ourselves is contained, you know, in all kinds of places. So, I don't have to tell you the heavy burden of responsibility that you have in terms of protecting the public and the public interest and individuals. This is an area that for most lay people, and I'd put myself in that category, is quite mind-boggling in terms of what would be required to protect people's privacy and confidentiality. And as I was reading the Auditor General's report, I was thinking probably in very simplistic terms, just from my own common sense understanding of computers and the experience I've had as an MLA, getting new IT in my office and having to dispose of the old IT. It was my understanding that a hard drive really can never be wiped, and that the information continues to be on that hard drive, even if it's encrypted, and that some computer genius someplace theoretically could undo the encryption. So can you explain this to us? What is encryption? What forms are you adopting, and how secure actually is that in the long term?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, I'll start talking about this, and I'll try to keep it as non-technical as possible, and I may hand over to Carolyn as well. So, first, there are different types of hard drives, and for example, hard drives that are in servers, and those servers would contain, I would say, highly personal information, because we're conducting many different types of transactions within government. So when it comes to a server hard drive, they're actually pulled out of the servers and they're taken to a disposal site where they're cut in half or three pieces or shredded. So we handle different devices differently depending on the risk associated with those devices. So then when it comes to personal computers, when the computer is operational and you're carrying it around, the best thing that we can do is to actually encrypt that hard drive. So somebody would have to really know how to break into a hard drive and kind of decrypt it, and you would need keys. Nothing is impossible, but what we do is we make it as difficult as humanly possible. So there are bad guys out there all the time looking at, you know, devious ways of doing everything and anything. And what we have to do is, what can we do that's the best thing that we can do in order to protect the devices and the information on those devices? There are times also when we get devices back and it's a laptop that hasn't been used for 2 or 3 years and the hard disk is suspect. So even if we try to turn the device on, it really doesn't turn on. Those hard drives are immediately removed and they're sliced as well, because we actually can't take them through a process to clean them that we're comfortable with. So that's a slightly different process depending on the situation. The other thing that we do with hard drives is, not only is it encrypted during its life, but when it comes in from a disposal perspective and we believe that we can wipe the hard drive so it can be reused, wiping is, I'll say, a bit of a physical process in that we degauss it, which is basically taking magnets, right, really, really strong magnets, and rolling them over the hard drives. And then what you do is you write ones and zeros over every part of the hard drive to overwrite the data, and we do that process at least 3 times. So with the original encryption, with the degaussing, with the overwriting of the hard drive multiple times, we're following what we believe are best industry practices so that the hard drives can be reused. There are a number of devices that we just, you know, depending on where they come from and the risk of the type of information on them, we just pull the hard drives out. But if there are, for other devices, we will wipe the hard drive and we will go through that very, very detailed process based on what cybersecurity folks are saying is the best process. We follow RCMP processes for wiping hard drives as well. And if we believe and feel that we've done the due diligence, that these devices then actually can be reused somewhere else in the system.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. The scope of your mandate, does it extend to the district health authorities and the school boards, or are you confined to government departments? Can you just give me an idea of the breadth of your responsibilities?
So we're responsible directly for government departments. We do work in collaboration and very, very closely with the district health authorities and the school boards. For example, a lot of the health information systems reside within our government data center. A number of the contracts that we negotiate from a volume perspective involves both education and health. In fact, involves, in some instances, Dalhousie and HRM from a whole volume buying perspective. So our direct scope of control is really from a provincial government perspective. But we actually open up to engage others and invite them in, hopefully to the benefit of their clients as well.
Thank you. A few years ago, I remember either at this committee or during the budget estimates, there was a report. It floored me. It talked about the number of laptops that went missing on an annual basis, and it was pretty high. So I'm wondering how many laptops have gone missing, let's say, in the prior 12 months, and how is that dealt with? What is the process that is used, first of all, to try to prevent the disappearance of laptops, and then how, if a laptop goes missing, how is the what procedure is in place to look at what information was on that laptop? What is the risk and the security implications?
So I'll just start with responding to this question, and I'll hand it over to Carolyn McKenzie for some other details. Laptops are highly mobile, and that's good, and laptops are highly mobile, and that can be a detriment to having a laptop. Certainly, one of the first things that we do is we encourage people not to leave their laptops in cars. Because lots of times laptops are left in cars, cars are broken into because it's a nice shiny device, and it's it can garner enough money on the market. So first is we do an education. We also have the ability to physically secure the asset to a desk. So even in an office situation, depending on how open your office is, there could be the risk of somebody walking in the door who is uninvited and just kind of walking by a desk and scooping up a laptop. So we actually have, and all laptops have it, is has the ability to have a cable and a lock put on the laptop, which is a combination lock, so it's kind of like a bicycle lock that you undo and you can take it away. So there are multiple different things we can do to secure the physical asset, and we do encourage and supply those types of things to our clients. With regard to the numbers and the process, I'll let Carolyn McKenzie take that.
Ms. McKenzie.
Thank you. So essentially, it's not a high volume that come in and report directly to us as Chief Information Office. In the last 12 months, I'm aware of two situations that have been directly reported into our office. But the process really is, if a laptop is stolen, we treat it almost as a potential privacy breach. So the process that's documented is it needs to be our service desk would inform a client, you know, you need to go talk to your privacy person and report it. You need to inventory what potential data may have been on that laptop. And then there's the process that's really from a privacy perspective that's launched within each department. So from my perspective, we haven't really seen a high volume, but whether or not they kind of come in and report or just deal with it as a breach, and then purchase a new laptop. So depending on the scenario and how educated the person is, the process may be different, but there is two that I'm aware of in the last year.
So in other words, you're saying it's not a requirement right now that if I was an assessor for home care.
Yeah.
I think that's out in the district now, but when it was in the Department of Health, if that laptop went missing, there wasn't a requirement that it be reported to you?
There's a requirement to be reported to privacy, mm-hmm. but we don't have a current process in place to report to CIO.
Right. So you would have no way of knowing.
Running a report to give you information at this point.
Is that something that you might address in the future? It seems to me that it would go very well with kind of the standardization that you're attempting to to get.
Yeah. And we're working on an IT asset management policy as well. So through that, you know, there's considerations about various scenarios, what would happen. So through that process, you know, I would expect that we would be able to address that, because a requirement would be to have the life cycle of the device managed through a system. So if it was lost, if it was, you know, reallocated to a different person, that some of the tracking of the asset mm-hmm. is made throughout the life cycle. Mm-hmm. So in the future, through continuous improvement, you know, I would expect that we would have that addressed.
One of the things that that strikes me as being really important is securing the data that MLAs have in their constituency offices. And, you know, I'm being fairly self-interested here in some ways, but it's the work I know best. And many, many constituents come to us, and they bring all kinds of personal information. And we are in communication with government departments and agencies, and often we have a lot of very sensitive information in our databases. Yet I'm not very sure, I guess, that we have the support or the training, the direction to help us secure that information. And it's always something that I know I and my colleagues are always very aware of and very concerned of, the trust that's placed in us by our constituents and the confidentiality that they require, but the limited capacity, I suppose, in some ways we have to deliver that to them in a kind of a technical way. We personally can, you know, do the best we can to ensure that we're not sharing documents inappropriately or whatever. But I'm wondering about the relationship of your department, your office, to the MLA's offices, and whether or not this is something you've considered as part of your mandate, and I particularly wonder about that since you've indicated that the Auditor General's office, for example, has some capacity, their arm's length. I suppose we'd be a little arm's length as well, and have capacity to act independently. But it's highly problematic from my perspective.
Ms. Cascade.
So an interesting opportunity and a learning experience kind of presented itself in the October timeframe with the change of government. And when we were trying to deploy different technologies and connect different people differently, it was a really incredible learning opportunity for me because it was the first time that I went through this process as the CIO. And many people actually reached out to us and asked us questions about how can we do this, how can we get everything from wireless connectivity through to sharing files, how can we, you know, what types of devices can we use, what types of devices can't we use. So my answer to the question is I would say that we probably haven't had the focus for these offices that we can, should, and are willing to have. So if these offices are interested in learning more about the technology and about what we can supply them to secure information and or even just to enable seamless movement of information, we are more than willing to work with people, more than willing. And we've actually had a number of those conversations already, but they have been one-on-one conversations.
Thank you.
Ms. McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much time do I have?
You have approximately 4 minutes left.
Oh, good. Thank you. I actually have one very, very specific kind of irritant to raise with you in a very polite way. It's about my old BlackBerry number. I had it from the time I was elected, but I took it with me when we were in government, and when I no longer was in government and returned my BlackBerry, I also lost that number, which is fine. However, that phone and that number is still active, and people are still calling a number that I had from the time I was first elected in 1998, so it's almost 16 years, and they still get my voice message, but I no longer have that phone or that number because it was turned in. So in checking with some of my other colleagues, they have indeed had the same experience. I think Mr. Corbett, for example, is in the same boat. So somewhere out there today in cyberspace, there is this phone number still active, still with my voice message that was on it, you know, 2 years ago, getting messages that I can't get. I have no idea unless somebody runs into me and is irate because I haven't returned their call. And so what can we do to fix that? And how is it possible that that has occurred?
Ms. Cascan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We try to manage all of those assets, and when we're given those assets and we're asked to turn them off, we have a process that we take them through. When we're engaged in that process early and in the right place, then we have a higher success rate of actually getting things turned off. If others are engaged in that process and don't pull us in, we actually don't know what should be turned off and what shouldn't be turned off. So I would say it's a process issue between the other people who are engaged in it and then us, who at the very, very tail end are actually managing the process. So certainly in your very specific instance, we will look into it. And in fact, what we'll do is we'll look into all of the transition phones over the next couple of weeks and deal with this issue specifically.
Thanks. It seemed my time is up.
I have to call order, but you can continue in the next round. We'll now move to the Liberal caucus, and who would... Mr. Rowe is beginning. Okay.
Certainly.
Mr. Rowe.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair, and thanks very much for your presentation this morning. I just had a couple of questions, actually, and most of them are primarily for clarification. Mm-hmm. Just in speaking about the phones, I'm curious about the passwords on the smartphones and when it became mandatory that there be a password on the smartphone. First of all, that's my first question.
I'll talk about the smartphones and the passwords and the why, and maybe Carolyn can answer exactly when. I'll take a stab at when, too. So from a device perspective, if it's a BlackBerry that you're using, the passwords go on at the very, very front of the BlackBerry. Because what we've done is we then have granted you access to the email system and to the calendaring system, for which after you put the BlackBerry password in, you don't have to put a password in for that. So we have to have one password somewhere, and the password for the BlackBerries, based on how we manage the BlackBerry system, is at the very, very top level, which is access to the entire BlackBerry. My understanding would be we put passwords on BlackBerries almost from day one, but I'll get clarification. Certainly, it's a little different when we're dealing with the iPhone application. And iPhones have a password for the iPhone itself, which you can turn on or you can turn off. And the way we're delivering services on an iPhone is we actually have a secure container. It looks like an app for your iPhone. That secure container requires a password, and then you get into the email system. So you're getting into email at a different level when you're using an iPhone. So you could actually take off your password for your full iPhone. So if somebody picked it up, they could see all your pictures and they could see everything, all your apps. But as soon as they saw the government container there, if they clicked on that, we put a password on that to protect the information contained within your email, your calendar, and the email system. Mm-hmm. So different devices we actually manage differently. So on the iPhone, if you wanted a password for your iPhone, you'd have password number one for the full phone, and then password number two would be for your container. The BlackBerry, it's password for the BlackBerry, and we open up the email after that BlackBerry password.
Okay, perhaps I misunderstood then. Has that always been the case? That was my question. Like 5 years ago, for example, 8 years ago, I guess my concern is, are there is potentially phones out there that are not password protected? Maybe that's a simpler way of putting the question.
So I'd like to hand this over to Blaine.
Mr. Maxwell.
Thank you. No, actually, when you say phones, we have to be careful because there are non-smartphones as well.
Right.
So, but the smartphones which would contain data, which would be the BlackBerries, no, they've always had the passwords on them, and they will. And actually, it has been enhanced, the password, so now you will notice it times out a little quicker and things like that. In fact, those who would have had the old BlackBerries would notice that, I should say. So that security has always been on there. And in fact, the BlackBerries, if you lose them, they'll be wiped automatically. In fact, the advantage of a BlackBerry over a laptop is the fact that because they're on the network, because they are that type of device, they can be wiped immediately as soon as they're reported lost.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Can I go back to wiping hard drives and using, and I think if I recall in the AG report, there was some indications of the software that's used to actually wipe the hard drive, and there were some deficiencies there that the software was really not geared for business use. Has that been addressed? If so, how? Could you shed a little more light on that, please?
Ms. Cascaden?
Thank you. The software that we are using is a smaller type of application, but it does do the job, and it was actually sanctioned by the RCMP a number of years ago. So it meets a certain CEA dot 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 dash 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 standard. Don't ask me what those numbers are. So it does meet those standards that the RCMP had at the time. Because we've been prioritizing all the other activities, we actually have not procured a corporate level application yet. But we are looking at the various types of applications that are out there that we could procure and we could bring into the government, and that would be our system solution. What we have to do when we are looking at procuring a piece of software like this, we have to say, exactly what do we want this software to do? So not only would we want it to wipe the devices, we would also want it to record its success rate of wiping. We would want it to record, be able to record the serial number of the machine of that from that hard drive. We want it to record the date it did the wipe. We would want to record the person who did the wipe and the verification. So the software we're looking for is just not a wiping software. We'd actually like it to have a front-end process to collect information so that we actually have it in an inventory and have records to prove that we wiped the hard drive. And then all of that information, we'd like to connect it to the Archibus system, which is the TIR asset management system, so that when that device is wiped, it actually goes into the asset system and says, this asset has been disposed of, and this asset was wiped on this date by this person, so carrying that information across. So it takes a while to put together all of those functional requirements of what we're looking for in an application. That's what we're doing now, and we're looking in the market to see which is the best application for us. So we are looking at replacing what we have.
Okay. One more, Mr. Chair?
Sure, Mr. Rowe.
Thanks very much. And my last question might be a little more difficult to answer. I'm trying to look to the future. Like many of my colleagues, I am hardly an expert. I do not envy your job at all in what you have to do. So it's out of my field. But what we do hear all the time is, you know, what you own today is already out of date. And what you're about to buy next week is probably out of date as well. So my concern is, how proactive are we being about looking to these issues down the road as the technology changes, as the people who are out there who are, you know, looking to be a little nefarious in their activities are also changing, they're becoming more educated and so on. How proactive are we there in looking at new methods of controlling our equipment?
Ms. Cascaden.
Thank you. We are being as proactive as we can, and I'll give you some examples of how we're doing
that. Please.
So one thing that we're doing is we subscribe to like cybersecurity forums, and we have communications with cybersecurity experts from a pan-Canadian perspective, and we look to understand the trends in the industry and what, you know, so should we be focusing on antivirus software, or is it malware that we should be focusing on from a securing of our asset perspective? So we're watching the industry, we're watching the trends, we're getting that information from the experts, including CSIS and other organizations, so that gives us a sense of kind of what we should be focusing on in the future. The other thing that we're doing is we also really understand industry trends of what's called BYOD, which is bring your own device. So instead of us, you know, you having your own personal cell phone and getting a government cell phone, and then you have your own personal iPad and getting a government iPad and getting a government desktop, there's a huge trend in the industry to bring your own device. And so we have to look at what does that mean for our ability to manage your device as you're using it to conduct our business. So that's the future stuff that we're looking at, and we're taking all of that into consideration now. The way that we actually set up the iPhones take into consideration the fact that you would, based on how we've configured those devices today, to actually bring your own device, and we could put that container on your device. So we are very actively looking at where the industry is going and trying to get out ahead of it. Really tough because it's moving really, really quickly, but we are taking all of those types of things into consideration to the best of our ability.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And do we have any other questions from the Liberal caucus? Ms. Treen.
Sorry, I have a cold. I don't hear very well today. I'm like clogged. I just have a couple of questions. In the report, it indicated that the inventory assets, the list was lacking on page 3. And I'm just wondering, is there a plan put in place for a stronger inventory tracking process? Is there something being put in place for that?
Ms. Cascade.
So I will start with a response and then hand it over to Blaine Maxwell. Certainly, as we have evolved from the CIO into the CIO, when each government department was doing their own individual procurements, then, you know, the asset and as being tracked starting from procurement was probably a bit hit and miss. As the CIO formed and as we've started putting standards and processes together, as more and more government departments have been utilizing our processes to procure assets, and we know when those assets are coming in the door, we actually can update that database, and that database is much more robust and accurate than it was in the past. So that's the high-level explanation of that, so I'll hand it over to Blaine for the details.
Mr. Maxwell.
Thank you. So, yeah, actually, Sandra started that off very well in that basically when a PC or a laptop or actually a BlackBerry is first brought into the government, we actually, going forward from about a year and a half ago, we actually record every single device. So the tracking of that, because we now have mostly a central control, and I say mostly because actually from a departmental perspective, there's still community services who will be bringing in, effective April 1st, their procurement over to our group, and at that group point we'll have all of the government departments proper. We will track all that inventory and assets as it comes in. That goes out to departments, and that's still a little bit of the weakness that we have, is when a department gets it, if they decide to move it to somebody else's desk or unplug it or somebody actually steals it from there, unless they notify us, we don't always have information on that. When the refresh takes place and that device is replaced, that's another opportunity for us to dispose of it and sort of tie the two records together. One of the things that we have most recently looked into and I think we're going to pursue is we actually have there's a tool that's being used. It's actually out of Vancouver. It's called CompuTrace that goes right on the BIOS, which I don't want to get too technical, but it goes right at the lowest level so people can't turn it off. That's the important part. And that will actually track your device down to actually a geographical region. And we will, as long as that device is connected to the network, the internet or our network, which is basically all devices nowadays, they can actually track it right down to where it is, whether it gets stolen, whether it gets moved, and we'll have that information all online. So we won't be relying on the departments necessarily to tell us where that information is. We'll be able to do that automatically. And that will be a big step forward, because that tool is actually being used by, it's actually the only, it's actually something to be quite proud of on a Canadian stand front, is it's the only company in the world that does this. And they've actually made deals with all of the major manufacturers of PCs, so this is incorporated into their PCs. They're also working with handhelds such as your Samsung, your iPhones, etc., to make sure they're actually putting it on those devices. So looking forward, they actually are looking forward to the mobility issues that may happen. And it's actually a relatively cost-effective solution. And it's being used by large organizations such as the Los Angeles School Board. I think they have 600,000 PCs, and they also have a recovery. You can actually buy an additional service where if it gets stolen, they'll actually recover it. In fact, in some of the larger cities in the U.S., this is the only tool they will recognize if you go to the police force to say, do you have this on there? If you do, they'll pursue it. If you don't, they won't pursue it. And we're looking at that right now, and that tool is actually very, very powerful, and it's something we're looking at. So I just wanted to make sure that we mentioned that as well. So.
Very interesting. Very interesting. We can track our phones. I like that. Computers. The other question, it's unrelated to that. We read the Auditor General's report, was there anything that surprised you regarding the disposal in the past for computers, or were there anything surprising in that report?
Ms. Cascade?
I don't think there was anything surprising in the report. We always look to the Auditor General's report as tools that we can use in order to better what we do. And when I looked at this report, that's what it actually pointed out. You know, so you do have a piece of software, but you should have a stronger one. You look after assets, but maybe you should tighten up that process. Departments do their own thing. Maybe you and the department should work together a little bit more to tighten up that whole process. So it's really a good, they hold up the mirror and really help you look at what you're doing, and you say, okay, we need to enhance what we have, what we've been doing. So I actually welcome this report, and it does help us move the yardstick forward when reports like this are public, and then it helps us get support in other areas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Treen. Mr. Goff.
I was just wondering if there are measures in place to prevent hacking of the government devices, either at home or if someone's traveling abroad.
Ms. Cascade.
So, from a hacking perspective, I'll go into that. It's a tough one.
Yeah.
So, when you think of your computer being hacked, the government systems potentially being hacked, what it means is you actually have to be attached to the internet for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So if you're sitting at home and your computer's not attached to the internet and you're not doing any internet activity, then the probability of you being hacked is going to slim to nil. If you happen to have a little wireless device at home and you don't put a password on it and you don't have protections on your own home PC, anybody driving by in a car can stop in front of your house, climb on your wireless network, and they're with you and your entire family.
Hmm.
From a government perspective, when people are have a government asset who are in their homes or abroad and they are connecting to the networks, the way that they connect to the networks are through our own VPN tunnel. And it's things like that actually mitigate the risk when you're out there. The bigger risk from a hack perspective is to the outside world, to the whole government network, because they're not really looking kind of at individual computers. When it's an individual computer, it's really more about a virus coming on from the internet, which really isn't a hack. It's a virus issue, or malware. Some malware, it would be a hack, and how that would come in is if your computer does not have the most up-to-date profiles on it from the antivirus software perspective. So if some of you have your home computers, it'll say, you need to update your antivirus now, and you click yes, it puts down a whole bunch of new signatures so that when you're out on the internet and somebody tries to do something bad to your machine says, oh, that name is a bad file name, I'm not letting that in. So one of the things that we do is we make sure that those signature files are up to date on every one of the government machines. And so there's some mornings you come in and you see the little blue wheel that it's rolling a little bit, and your system is saying, don't shut off your system, we're doing updates, or an update's coming through and you have to push yes. Those signature files are getting updated at that point. And with those signature files being updated, the personal computer is protected. When we look at the whole government network, and we think of the government network as an enclosed circle, and the rest of the world outside that circle, the way we connect to the rest of the world is through that internet connection. There are a number of things that are between us in the circle and them in the outside world which actually block bad things from coming in. Those things are firewalls. Right, so we have a major firewall for the government. We also have part of processes, which would be standard security processes. We know where the bad guys are. We know what countries they're coming from. We know the IP addresses. We block those IP addresses. So we know a lot of that activity. And again, you know, we work with other cybersecurity people so that if you know that there's things coming in from Asia or you know there's things coming in from South Africa, we all have those blocked. But all of a sudden, if something pops up from the Ukraine, that information is shared amongst the cybersecurity community, and then we put IP addresses on our own firewalls. We also have opportunities to work with our internet provider. So not only do we block it, the internet provider that connects us to the world, they also have a level of blocking at that internet provider. So there are multiple different filters here, both from a whole government perspective and from your own individual PC perspective.
Order, please. I don't like to interrupt you because it's interesting to hear what you have to say, but we'll move back to the PC caucus now for 12 minutes of questioning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to talk a bit about the disposal piece of things in the few minutes I have, and we've heard a bit about the hard drives and whether they're wipeable or they're not, and you've explained to some degree that they are. And this committee always takes this stance of looking back at what costs are associated with doing things and so on. Has it ever been costed out? Because obviously there's a cost with doing this procedure of wiping and somebody spending time in that, or you have a specialist that does that, or two or three, or whatever it might be. Is a cost analysis ever been done to compare the cost of just replacing the hard drive and throwing it away, smashing it, whatever you would do with it, as opposed to wiping them? And when you disposed of the asset, you know, if someone went to surplus and picked it up, you know, the deal would be you would put your own hard drive in it, but here's the box and everything else. Have we done that?
Ms. Cascade.
Thank you. I will hand this over to Blaine because he has all the detail around the hard drive disposal.
Mr. Maxwell.
Yes, actually, we have looked at that. In fact, especially the cost of the drive. So the other factor that probably is expensive is the labor that's involved in removing a drive. So when you do a wipe, it's actually much less labor intensive. So that's why we actually prefer the wipe method if it will get rid of the data. One of the things that I don't think was mentioned is I think RCMP actually have done forensic studies on these drives afterwards, and the recovery rate of the data is it's basically impossible to get the data. So that we are very confident in the wipe. The problem with our wipe is it just doesn't have reporting tools. And that's just to go back to that, that's a little bit of the reason why the Auditor General picked up on that. So what we've now do is we do actually manually record those, and that actually has added to our labor costs, obviously. So we have found that we've probably increased like a half FTE, basically based on some of these. So we know we've increased our costs, but we also realize that's very important. But to take out a drive, for example, you're talking significant amount plus the cost of the drive. And because 90% of these go to computer for schools, there's a value that they get out of them as well. So it's actually would almost be double exercise. It would be us taking them out, taking the labor, and then actually them putting another one in. The cost of the drives are coming down, and that actually has been considered.
Thank you for that. Yeah. How often, what's the turnover? You know, what's the age of a computer when you're turning it over and replacing it?
Basically, it's what we call a 4 or 5 year cycle. After 4 years, we start looking at it for refreshment, and depending on where we are at that time, we won't let them go any longer than 5 years.
What's refreshment mean?
Oh, I'm sorry. Refreshment means basically that's the point where we determine that the machine should be replaced.
Okay.
So we maintain that in inventory, the age. In fact, with our new inventory, keeping track of all the devices, we will know exactly when devices are coming due. In fact, it's one of the areas when we were talked about going with IMP and HP. They actually, IMP is the vendor who sells us locally. They actually work very closely with us on that process, and that's been an improved process. At one time, you probably heard of a lot of PCs getting purchased at the end of the year as budgets were people wanted to make sure they got their budgets. We now have that, so we don't have that big, because it's for us, it wasn't the budget issue. It was the fact that we'd have 2,000 PCs coming in within the last 3 months of the year and trying to roll those out. So what we now do is we forecast that out throughout the year, and that is actually how that would all be managed.
I see. So you're on the 4 or 5 year then, and things wouldn't go any longer than that?
That's correct.
But yeah. A little bit about the hard drive question I had. You're fairly confident, obviously, that the wiping is working well. It's had some audit done on it by professional people. Generally speaking, the average person couldn't get anything off it. Maybe the expert couldn't get anything off it. I don't know. Somebody who's really tech-savvy couldn't get anything off it. So there obviously is a low risk of it going. Knowing a lot of them go to the school or something, it's highly unlikely that anything would happen there anyway.
That's
You're
great.
Obviously quite confident in that. Okay.
Yes.
In my office, just as an example, for the last 3 years, I think we're in year three, in an effort to get rid of paper, if you will, although that was once upon a time thought that was going to happen with the world of technology, but I believe it's increased, we actually built a database for constituency business. So if somebody calls my office, it's recorded electronically versus a paper file. We haven't done that. I think we're in year three now of doing that. I back those up on an external hard drive, obviously, you know, for obvious reasons and so on. I replaced that computer that was quite a few years old just recently through your process. Should those, and I haven't disposed of that yet, it's in process of, you know, how should that be wiped? I mean, obviously there's a fair bit of significant information on there, which I'm not even allowed to pass on to the member down the road that will replace me.
Right.
As it stands, I'm not, you know, due to confidentiality and so on. Should that go through a certain procedure through your department, or should that be?
It absolutely should. I mean, because we are, we do this regularly, so we have all the processes and policies in place to do this. So we would gladly take that on. In fact, okay. I don't. Again, when you get into the arm's length, it's been a little bit less clear.
Sure.
But I would encourage that. And in fact, I was glad to hear you saying you're backing it up, because actually now all of a sudden you've got to consider that backup drive as well.
Yeah.
One of the things that, again, hasn't been mentioned is we actually discourage people from storing things on their hard drives. Everything really should be stored on the server, so that's actually part of an education process as well. So if you took the actual proper use of a computer, the really only private information would basically be emails. And then it would be stored onto the corporate system. But yes, no, we would willingly take that on, but absolutely that should be destroyed.
I agree, and we're moving to that as well, sort of everything going to the backup, you know, or the external hard drive, whatever you want to call it, versus hanging around on the main desktop or something. But that being said, you know, I don't know if you can buy anything anymore that's not 50 gig or 100 gig or whatever they come in now. I mean, I don't know what people do with all this space. I guess if you're recording or you're doing something, maybe there's a use, you know, somebody a lot more tech savvy than myself. But I mean, the database doesn't take up, it's just an Access and now an Excel database. It doesn't take up a lot of space, so they're very easily moved about and backed up and so on. But very curious about that. So I couldn't get my local IT folks that have done work for me, you know, in the past. I've got a local company down there too that do work. Would they be of that level? Or again, I just want to stress this because it is in the process now of me getting rid of that.
Right.
You would recommend through you?
I would recommend through us because I know our processes. Local companies probably would have various standards. I would hope that they would recognize the importance and what to do.
Mm.
At the very least, you could ask for any certifications they may have or what their process are and whether they're certified. But I'd highly recommend them coming through us. And we can, if you wish, you can call myself directly or we can get in touch with you and provide you with a contact.
Yeah, that's great. I appreciate that very much. And Mr. Chair, that's my questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. We can now move to the NDP caucus and Ms. McDonald.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the two computers that you know of that have gone missing and just ask a bit more about that. I'm wondering if those computers were encrypted or not, and what departments those computers were from.
Ms. Cascaden.
So, on this one, I'd like to hand it over to Carolyn.
Ms. McKenzie.
Thank you. So they were not encrypted, as we just recently started the encryption process March 4th of this year. But the two departments that had reported them, one was from TIR and one was from Community Services, and they both followed the process of reporting through their privacy group to do an assessment of risk. So, you know, so at that point, they would have assessed within their department. We wouldn't have had an outcome of the that assessment of risk but I do know that Community Services, for example, does have a departmental policy not to store local data on their hard drive due to the nature of their data. So it would be deemed, you know, from my, you know, without knowing the details of the device that was stolen. So
thank you. I want to ask you about the recommendations from the AG. At the outset, you said you had prioritized them, and you gave us kind of an update of what you intend to do and where you're at in the process, but I didn't actually catch the priority in which you've ordered the recommendations, and I wonder if you could give us some clarity around that. I know you did indicate that the first priority was encryption and starting with the mobile devices, but can you just tell us the priority in which you've ordered them, and then how long will it be before they're fully implemented?
Ms. Cascaden.
Certainly. From a priority perspective, there's priorities and then sub-priorities, and we can actually work on multiple things at different times because different groups are responsible for these. So the ones that we have worked on that I commented on today, those ones were put in the kind of the priority one bucket. So okay. Instead of saying this is priority one, two, and three, I'll put them in
right.
A bucket. The ones that were left to a little bit later, because it's going to take longer to do them, is the procurement of the software, for example, because we have to go through a longer process. So what we did is we assessed the risk associated with not having that software. Well, we actually have software that wipes, and that software wipes well. It isn't a fully automated process. We have to put manual processes around that. Are we willing to do that at this time? Yes, we are, because what has a higher priority is the encryption. And we need to put those same resources that would be having those conversations about the software, we actually need to put them on the encryption project. So when I was going through each one of these, we've actually tackled each one because different groups can do it. So it's more of a prioritization bucketing because even inside the encryption, we prioritized laptops, not desktops. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a roundabout way of answering your question, but it's really not 201 was number one, 208 was number two. Right. We looked across all of these to see which parts of those that we could move the yardstick forward on.
And when do you plan to implement all of the... What is the objective or the goal in terms of time frame to implement the recommendations?
So with these different types of recommendations, some of them are relatively easy to say, check, we've done. Right? So we have purchased a piece of software. Okay, we can check that off. But does that actually address the recommendation of completing the documentation, tying it into the TIR application? So the procurement of the software, even though it takes a while to do to get it from a functional perspective, we could procure it, but we still, from an Auditor General's perspective, haven't fulfilled the whole intent of the recommendation until it's a completely automated process and tied into Archibus. That could take 2 years. So some of these could take 2 years. Others, for example, even though we put a priority on encryption, it actually will take a 4-year cycle to complete. Because first we're doing laptops that are capable of being encrypted, then we're doing everything that's purchased from April the 1st on a go-forward basis. And if our computers are being updated every 4 years and into the fifth year, we will have completely gone through a cycle of new computers in 4 years. So it will be that 4-year/5-year mark before we can say all the computers are encrypted. So some of them are longer term. So the Auditor General may say, well, great, you started encryption, but until every single asset's encrypted, you're not finished this one. So it all depends on, you know, what parameters we put on done or complete. So it could be up to 4 years if you look at one of the longest cycles here.
It's hard to envision what the world could be like as well, that world in 4 years' time. I'm wondering, do you provide verification to the client that the asset has been securely disposed of? So do the departments or whatever the client groups are, do you provide any written reassurance to them that their asset has been adequately dealt with?
Ms. Cascade?
That was one of the recommendations in the Auditor General's report, that we actually communicate back to the departments. So as we're building our process, we're building that communications plan back to them. So up to this point, I would say we don't have a robust process communicating back to the departments. The robust process is more about, we're in replacing your old asset. How do you get your old asset to us? And we've strengthened the process of our own internal processes. Now we have to look externally to say, are we educating each one of the leads in the various departments about what their role and responsibility is in asset management, because they have a role in this? Do we communicate back with them that the asset has been disposed of and what direction we took on the disposal of that asset at what time? Those are areas where we have to strengthen our processes. Okay. And they're being looked at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. We'll move on to the Liberal Caucus. Mr. Irving, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Kasdan and colleagues, for all the work you've done on this. This is clearly extremely important, and it appears you've made significant progress. I guess my first question is, through the work that you've done so far and then also looking forward, have there been I think you mentioned a half FTE, but are there other staff or budget implications that have come out of this Auditor General's report up to this point and in terms of additional resources going forward to complete the recommendations?
Ms. Cascaden?
Thank you. Certainly, when we start to look at procuring anything net new from a financial perspective, that'll be a plus from a budget perspective. So at this point, until we have actually decided the functionality of the new secure wiping software and what we're looking for, we don't have a cost associated with that yet from just a straight procurement perspective. Certainly, as we increase the robustness of our processes and we really look to doing appropriate tagging and tracking and documentation, we are concerned that the staff that we have in this particular area, it will not be enough staff to actually do to the level of due diligence, which we believe with the Auditor General we need to do it at. So there are absolutely some implications to kind of stepping up our game. There's no doubt about it, both from a hard perspective that we're going to have to procure some additional tools. We can't tell you right now what those costs will be because we're just scoping out what our requirements are. But we are concerned about the number of staff that we have in this particular area and the added workload that we'll be putting on the staff because we have stepped up in our processes.
Thank you. The area that, and there's been some good questions here that have been insightful, but there seems to be, for me, still a question about responsibility. We seem to be transitioning to a more rigorous system, but you've used language such as departments do their own thing and we offer our services. And there remains for me a question in terms of the ABCs and their independence, yet we are building this knowledge and policy development around a more secure, more rigorous system. Whose ultimate responsibility does this issue lie with? I'm sensing that you are trying to nurture departments and ABCs. Is that the way it is and should be, or do you have some suggestions in terms of policy changes?
Ms. Cascaden.
Thank you. Certainly, the model that we have from a CIO or Chief Information Office perspective right now, and I'll say that because as of April the 1st, it's going to be slightly different with the new Internal Services Department for which we are now part of. The model that was put in place when the CIO came to be in 2009, it looked at all of the different government departments who all had their own individual IT shops, and they were all doing things differently. Like I mentioned before, they were doing procurement differently. They were they had different standards. And when it was pulled together into the CIO, the parts that were taken out of the various departments were the hard stuff. If anyone was looking after a server, they came over to the CIO. If anyone was doing help desk activity, they came over to the CIO. If anyone was doing desktop support, they came over to the CIO. That structure stopped short of other IT people who support applications that are very, very specific for that department. So there is an IT structure that still remains in each one of the government departments, which gives them the latitude to do things either completely aligned with us, partially aligned with us, or not aligned with us at all. And that structure, I'll say, is a much more of a federated model. So the Chief Information Office is not the one and only entity that has some role and responsibility and accountability for IT in the government at this point. So it is a federated model that each of the departments do have autonomy to do certain activities themselves. What we have had to do, coming together as the CIO, is we have had to demonstrate to them that we can deliver a good service to them, that we can deliver a service in a timely manner, that they can trust us in the delivery of that service. So come and be partners with us. So we do not have that dictatorial, for lack of a better word, relationship. It's much more of a collaborative relationship, and it's a relationship building. But different groups, depending on what they are, and it's kind of different for each group. It's different from a government department than it would be for an agency board or commission, or for a district health authority or a regional school board. So we have to work with each one of these entities depending on what type of entity they are, respecting what their mandate is. So it's complex. It is complex. If you're feeling it's complex, it is complex.
So at this time, no particular policy changes or suggestions that would make your job easier, I guess?
So I believe there are opportunities to broach this subject with the advent of the Internal Services Department.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Irving. Mr. Stroink?
Just have one question. Thank you very much for coming out today. The question kind of relates to the chart in the report on page 11 on application controls. Was the attempt being made to ensure things like password, lock screens, automatic expiry are being implemented across all departments, or is that possible?
So I don't have that specific one in the quick... hold on. Take a look at that.
Yeah,
certainly,
no worries.
from our perspective, it's any system that is a corporate system for which we manage, those types of securities are put in place on all the systems because we program them that way. If you try to put in a password that's too short, it says try again, and it keeps saying trying again. The specifically, this one was about, I think, the inventory management software that was in use at various entities. So it kind of goes back to transportation infrastructure renewal has the responsibility within government to manage all assets. It is their mandate to have this database to manage all assets. So all assets are in this database: chairs, desks, computers. And that's the application that the Auditor General commented on here with regard to how robust that application is. And when the auditor did their comments on, it's called the Archibus application, you probably saw it mentioned a couple of times. When the auditor did their look at this application, it was at a certain revision or version number, and Transportation Infrastructure Renewal are upgrading that application that will take care of most of the X's in the column for that application. Both Community Services and Justice both had their own inventory systems for which they were keeping their own individual inventories outside of the TIR system. Both of these groups are coming on board with the TIR system. So this is one of the benefits of having an Auditor General report that points this out, and then just by having conversations with both Justice and with Department of Community Services, people see the logic and the opportunity to climb on board one asset management system for government.
Thank you. That's all I had.
Mr. Goff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your answer to the last question. I know we ran out of time, but I have one other question here. I'm just wondering if you could tell us about the average number of computers that get disposed of on an annual basis, and what happens to these computers?
Ms. Cascade?
Thank you. So when you think of the fact that we have, I'll just round it up, approximately 10,000 computers. Okay, I just rounded down because we actually have 10,900, but just for the math. And we recycle computers every 4 years. So So a quarter of those computers get recycled. So a quarter of 10,000, so 2,500 computers actually get recycled on an annual basis. So those are the ones that we have to document, track, and everything through the process. Out of that number, actually 90% of those computers go to computers for schools. And so we actually are, I'll say, highly successful in the redeployment of computers to schools and other places than schools, but very similar to schools. It's through the Computers for Schools program, and which means that they can be reused again. The computers themselves, what happens is, inside government, we may buy a new application, and it may require much more horsepower on that computer than that computer can provide. And so as soon as we buy that application, the computers that use it have to be upgraded. It doesn't necessarily mean that that computer is bad, because automatically, if those computers are too old, what we do is we take out the hard drives, destroy the hard drives, and we take out any other pieces that we may want in our own supply to fix other computers, and then it goes to the ACES recycling. So then those older computers are recycled. So we have a standard for which we will not go below when giving those computers to Computers for Schools, because we actually don't want to transfer the cost of maintenance to those folks if those computers are really, really old.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Goff. If there are no other questions, we will give you an opportunity, Ms. Cascadden, and your office to provide some closing comments.
Thank you. Certainly, I hope that what we've been able to communicate with you is that we, too, are serious about managing this process, managing the assets on behalf of our clients inside government, that we've actually taken this this audit report very, very seriously. We've managed to move forward on many of these recommendations in a fairly significant way when you consider that this report was actually released in November 2013. So we've actually made very, very good inroads, and it's kudos to the folks that I have on both the left and the right of me and their teams. And I sincerely hope that we've been able to communicate that we are moving the yardstick forward, and we do truly believe that this is an important thing for which we have a role and responsibility and accountability and authority to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cascadden. And with that, we do have some committee business. We do have a briefing coming up at 11 a.m., and that will be on occupational health and safety. Before we get to that, I would like to remind members of the committee that we have meetings upcoming, including on March 26th. We have a meeting with the, with the Department of Labor and Advanced Education. But after that, we have a subcommittee meeting, and we will be discussing subjects to come up at future dates for this committee, and also to discuss and some outstanding issues, including one on pension valuation adjustment, and to discuss another recommendation put forth by the Liberal Caucus with regard to the proposals of the Auditor General. Specifically, we would like the Auditor General's office to explore the idea of ranking recommendations from the most important, which should be done immediately, to items that can wait a little longer to a later date. So that's something we'll discuss in our subcommittee meeting at that time. And so we have also a meeting on April 2nd with the Department of Health. That is actually going to be moved to April 9th. So we won't have a meeting on the 2nd. But we will be moving that topic ahead 1 week. So with that, I'd like to take a short recess and make sure everybody is back for the briefing coming up at 11 a.m. And we might even be able to get it on the way a little bit earlier if we can. So I will come and collect you if we have our presenters ready. Thank you.